Let's get started. Just a couple of announcements, or one in particular. Let's get started. I blew it on the page for the term papers. I just forgot to revise the thing and get it ready for today. I will get it ready for Tuesday, and it's possible maybe I can email it to you. I have your list now made out of email addresses. Also, my apologies, I sent out one email and forgot to put the addresses on blind copy, so you've got a huge list of email addresses. Usually I put them on blind copy when I send them out, and I just wasn't thinking that day. Greg, any announcement, or Rob? Okay. It's interesting. Walking across the campus today, I was getting positively nostalgic about my last semester teaching and thinking what an incredible luxury it's been to be a professor at Cornell. And among the finest things of teaching at Cornell is you have an almost endless supply of really, really good students. And that just makes all the difference when you're teaching, to have bright, eager students who want to learn. But I was thinking as I was walking across campus of one of my members of my doctoral committee at Harvard. I actually had three committee chairs, and two of them died along the way, and I think the third one was a little uneasy about taking the job, but we survived that. But Arthur Darby Nock was on my committee, and he was one of the youngest professors, full professors, Harvard ever had. He became a full professor at age 29. He was a classicist. He remained a bachelor throughout his life, and unfortunately had a very sad life. He became an alcoholic during the end of his life, and his life was very, very difficult in some ways. He was absolutely brilliant. He was just a walking encyclopedia, and I used to love to go to his digs, as he called them. He had a series of rooms in one of the Harvard houses, and he would tell stories, and it was just part of the luxury of being a graduate student. But I can remember one time in seminar, very shortly before he died, actually. He died, he was only in his early 60s, I think. There were maybe 12 or 14 students in the seminar, and he got tears in his eyes, and he really got very emotional, and he would refer to us graduate students as his dear children. And we were like his family in a way. But he was an incredibly interesting and unpredictable person. There was a whole lore of stories about him, one of which that I like very much was during the World War II, the president of Harvard, I don't remember if it was Eliot or who it was at that time, had his house right across the street from where Arthur Darby Nock had his digs, and let's say it was Mrs. Elliott, I don't remember that for sure. She was entertaining, had a very important party with many dignitaries. And Arthur Darby Nock had the rather unusual habit in the summertime or early fall, when it got really hot, he would just take off his clothes and work in the nude. And he had these big lexicons and big scholarly tomes that he would walk around with. Well, this particular evening of the party, he forgot to pull the shades. And as it got dark, Mrs. Elliott noticed that the guests were sort of congregating at the windows and tittering a little bit. And she didn't know what was going on, but she walked over and looked, and there was Arthur Darby Nock parading back and forth. He was a rather portly gentleman by that time, totally in the nude. And she immediately got on the phone and let him know that she wasn't very happy about this. And she said she thought it might just be possible for him to attire himself somewhat more appropriately. And he was very cordial and said, apologized, said, "I'm quite sorry." She had said this was an important event, you know. And so he disappears, only to reappear a moment later, still totally in the nude except for a black silk top hat. But there was a whole range of stories. He hated Radcliffe students. Radcliffe and Harvard used to be more separate than they are today, and he particularly hated their bicycles because I think he wasn't always quite sure on his feet, particularly if he'd been drinking a little too much, and these undergrads zipped around very fast. And I can remember one day coming out of the Fogg Museum where the road in front of it is a slight upgrade, and this was before many people had gear shifts and so on. So there was this undergraduate, this Cliffy, standing up on the pedals going up this hill, and he walks right up to her and gets about so far from her and goes, boom! And this poor girl just lifted. I thought she was going to have an accident, but he was an incredibly learned and interesting and odd sort of person. But I was thinking of him as I was walking across the Ag Quad and realizing what an incredible luxury to be a professor at Cornell and what a good life it is. The topic today is an interesting topic. The topic for the week is the limitations of rationalism in ethics. I want to suggest that there are two major areas, I'm sure there are probably others, the two that I'm particularly interested in, where we have become rationalistic about ethics in a way that is hurtful, in a way that is overly limiting. The first one has to do with the question of whether men and women typically look at moral issues, ethical issues, in a somewhat different way. I'm not talking about individuals, I'm talking about the bell curves, overlapping curves. It's a topic that I've been interested in for many years because my PhD work at Harvard focused on different ways in which male, female as categories were used in ancient literature to talk about life and reality. So I've had a lifelong interest in this topic. I've been very deeply influenced by writers like Carol Gilligan. I don't know if any of you have read any of her works, this particular book, In a Different Voice. She's a feminist with quite a bit of influence on different fields, but particularly the field of ethics. She worked for some years with Lawrence Kohlberg at Harvard, then became a professor in her own right. And she argues in this book that there is a great deal of empirical evidence that men and women on average, again, we're not talking about individuals, we're talking about averages or, as I said, overlapping bell curves, that men and women on average look at moral reality, look at ethical issues in somewhat different ways. She argues that men tend to be more object-focused, more focused on specific rules and justice principles, more focused on getting exactly the right answer, and that women, on average, tend to be more relationship-oriented. They tend to look at moral reality more in terms of sustaining relationships, in terms of categories like concern, care, love, forgiveness, reconciliation, alienation, a range of categories that focus on how human beings are in community or relationship with each other. Men focusing more on getting hard and fast rules, regulations, principles of justice, women more on relationships. And she argues, and I think that she's exactly right about this, that by not taking account of this, that we prejudice women very deeply in our society. For instance, Lawrence Kohlberg, in his Stages of Moral Growth, about which I have questions in a more general sense, but she raises the question that it seemed exceedingly odd to her that women tended always to come out one or two stages lower in these tests than men, suggesting that somehow women weren't as fully developed morally or ethically than men. And that certainly seemed counterintuitive. And what she began to realize is that virtually all the research was done with boys and men rather than with girls and women, and that there was no apparent awareness of the fact that women might look at moral reality differently. They might be more concerned in maintaining relationships than in getting the exact right answer. And so she focused on much of her research on this. She built somewhat on the work of the developmental psychologist Piaget and looked at just all kinds of data. One example, for instance, there's very good evidence that when little boys and girls played games together, and I'm not sure if some of this would need to be repeated today after kids spend so much time with television. I just don't see kids playing games like we used to. We didn't have television, and we spent an enormous amount of time in the afternoon playing in the late afternoon, early evening, after supper, playing games together. But I think it probably would hold. She noted, for instance, that when a group of little girls were playing a game and got in an argument about the rules of the game, typically they would stop playing the game and play another game. Whereas when little boys were playing and got in an argument about the rules of the game, they would argue and argue, sometimes even fight with each other until they settled the issue and then go back to playing the game. This is just one of many, many examples where apparently it was more important for the girls to maintain the relationship. They didn't want to act in a way that might end up threatening the relationship over the long term. That was more important than getting the exact right answer about the rules of the game. Just at breakfast this morning, my daughter's visiting, and she has a friend with her who is an art historian and has been interested in male-female issues in art and so on. And she said, oh, when I mentioned what I was going to talk on this morning, she said, oh, that's interesting. I'm also quite interested in this. And she mentioned some research that was done very recently with boys and girls. And I don't remember the exact details, but roughly they each had a certain number of cookies that they were supposed to give to some other children and persuade them to eat them. And the girls in almost, do any of you know this research? Have you seen it reported on? It apparently the girls with high consistency would use an approach about how good they tasted and how fine they were for your health and what a great thing this would be to eat these cookies. And the boys took a much more sort of mundane approach. They tried to bribe the other kids, you know, they'll do other things for them, or they tried to threaten them. And it was quite a different approach to this particular assignment that they had. Where I think this research is extremely important is that it strikes me that the deeper prejudice in American society and much of the Western world today, and perhaps in many parts of the world, is not simply that women have been excluded from certain jobs, have been excluded from college and graduate school to some degree, all of which, in my judgment, clearly needed changing. But it seems to me the deeper prejudice, as I hinted at in a couple earlier lectures, is that as a society, we have a very, very pervasive bias towards what I think are more masculine male aspects of reality. Competition, very tight logical argument, a whole way of trying to analyze things into very exact principles, and so on. And the whole side of reality that has more to do with nurturing behavior, with intuitive understanding, with relational realities, where I think the evidence does show that women on the whole are more sensitive and more competent than men on average, this whole side of reality tends to be undervalued. So it seems to me that to some extent, some of the gains that we have had in male-female relations, where women have had better access to jobs and university positions and so on, I think have been in part undercut because, for instance, when Cornell hires women faculty, basically they expect them to act just like men, do the same kind of research, have the same kind of very, very analytical, objective analyses, and so on. And it seems to me that if the kind of work that Piaget, Gilligan, and now many other writers are doing is correct, that that is a very, very serious prejudice and one that harms us all in the long run. Because my view, for instance, in my own field of ethics, is that even though we cannot give a tight logical argument, we can't produce an algorithm or specific rules for how the intuitive and the more analytical fit together, I believe both are necessary in most life situations if we're going to do full justice to moral reality. That is, we can't figure out exactly how you take both of these into account, but it seems to me there are strong reasons for believing that both are important. And that's one of the reasons that I'm very conservative, for instance, about the issue that children typically need both mothers and fathers, both male and female role models, because on average I think they have different things to contribute. So it would seem to me that where we need to be open in the field of ethics is to the possibility that this male-dominated field, which has focused so much on exact justice principles, and if you go into some of the philosophical journals in ethics, they're extraordinarily tightly argued and very, very detailed, and in some ways, I think, extremely constipated. They don't seem to have much sense for the ambiguities of life that novelists often have, and dramatists, and artists, and so on, where life can't always be figured out very exactly. And so my suggestion is, in this field of ethics, that here is one area where we simply need to broaden the scope. To realize that as human beings we're very different, and to some extent male and female are very different, and we need to take this into account. One of the more interesting aspects of this issue is that since we have now more refined techniques with PET scans and MRIs and very sophisticated equipment for studying the brain, we're actually finding out in detail that on many issues, many problems, many things that we confront as human beings, men and women process problems in different parts of the brain. This is extraordinarily interesting data that we have. I may have mentioned in an earlier lecture, I don't remember, that we now know, for instance, that when the baby is in utero and the testosterone courses through the male baby, the corpus callosum, which connects the two hemispheres of the brain, shrinks greatly in the male child, the male baby, and thus the connections between the right and left hemispheres are probably considerably more tenuous. And this very likely explains why women seem to be more flexible in using both hemispheres. Men tend to be a little more monomaniacal in using one or the other, and may also explain why men may excel in things like theoretical math or physics, women in other areas. It's a wonderfully interesting topic. It might, to quote Jim Tantillo, never too early to look for a term paper topic. It might be a topic some of you want to pursue as a term paper topic. Let me pause here before going on to the next section and love to get some of your reactions and comments, questions. Yes, not nice and loud, Edwina.
You're listening to me that only recently people favored the male partner
more than the female one? Is this a recent thing? No, it isn't in many ways. In many ways, for instance, I focus my doctoral research on the Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria. And some of the courses in women's studies occasionally over the years have used a book I wrote on that as an example of how badly women were treated, because Philo really had the very clear sense that the higher intellectual functions and almost everything good and positive was to be found mainly in men, and women were much more closer to the earth, and he had a very negative view of human sexuality and so on, and women didn't come out very well. I think the evidence varies, actually. In ancient Jewish society, to some extent, for instance, women were quite independent in the household and had a, as is true today in Amish and some Mennonite circles. I had a doctoral student work on this who the dominant theory was that Amish women were almost like children. They weren't highly individuated. They were just under the thumb of men. And what he found out was almost the opposite, that in their own domain, they ruled the roost, so to speak. They were very focused and had a lot of responsibility and so on. So I think the evidence varies. But in many ways, I think this is a fairly old belief. You get it in Plato and others. Men really do come out better in most of these analyses because I think they were just so prejudiced that they really weren't willing to look at life more dispassionately. Now, my argument is that to some degree, modern feminism has entailed a very deep hatred of the feminine. I think that one of the problems of much modern feminism is that by trying to, in effect, argue there are no significant differences intellectually and emotionally and so on between men and women, by trying to argue that being a bank president or a college president is much more important than being a mother and a nurturer of children, I think they have really bought into the prejudice that only masculine type activities are really valuable and important. And I think that's tragic in a way, because I think the deeper liberation comes when we allow each individual to choose her or his own profession and way of life, and not to, as has so often happened in feminist circles, to see child nurture and being a homemaker and so on as a distinctly inferior activity. I think that's just been part of this deeper prejudice. And I've had women over the years come into my office when we had talked about this issue in class, and sometimes in tears, saying, you know, I really want to be a mother and have children and be a homemaker, but I feel so guilty. You know, everybody makes me feel like I'm going to be a failure if I do this. That's really what I want to do. And I think that's tragic. And it's partly related to this devaluation of nurturing type behavior. Rick, you had a comment?
Yeah, does this relate to Wendy Shalit's book?
The book that Rick is referring to is a book we've read sometimes in this course, or at least in my seminar, maybe. Her book, A Return to Modesty. She was a secular Jew who became fed up with the very, very loose sexual standards at, I think she's at Williams College. And as a senior and then just out of college, she wrote this book where she went back and explored Jewish traditions about modesty, And what she discovered was that modesty always was in the service of sexuality, that modesty wasn't opposed to sexuality, but was really one of the ways in which sexuality was heightened and appreciated more fully. And I think there is a connection here, because I think one of the areas where the feminist movement made a huge mistake, an absolutely tragic mistake, is to believe that because men had been rather promiscuous over the centuries and millennia, that now that women were going to be equal to men, they could be just as promiscuous if they wanted to. And I think this simply has been a tragic mistake, because I think there are all kinds of psychological reasons, as well as medical reasons. Women are much more susceptible to most STDs and so on. I think that's a tragic mistake. I think promiscuity and patterns like hooking up and all of this take a far greater toll on women than men. I think they're undesirable and morally wrong in both cases, but I think that when the feminists took this route that if men can do this, women ought to be able to do this too, I think that was partly buying into this same idea that liberation is to be able to be just like men. And what I think is gradually happening as a result of the work of Gilligan and others is that women are gradually beginning to do what blacks and other groups are doing when blacks said, hey, black is beautiful. We don't have to be like whites in every respect or in any particular respect. Black is beautiful. And I think what the culture most deeply needs is the realization that the feminine, the female woman, is beautiful. And women don't have to be like men in order to be valuable. So I think Wendy Shalit's book is relevant. It really adds quite a bit to the discussion. She's a young author, and I think the book, you know, isn't great literature, but I think it's an extremely significant study. And I was impressed with how many of the students in the class found it a really important book, an important book to read. You know, I sometimes have asked my seminar, I don't know if I typically ask it in 407, but I ask them when we talk about this issue, do you think men treat women better today than 50 years ago? And I think the answer is clearly no. I think men treat women much worse today. I think they are much less considerate, much less, much more focused on their own gratification and pleasure, and women can't walk around with the same safety and so on that used to be the case in most cities. 50 years ago, 60 years ago, you could send a 10, 12-year-old, 13-year-old girl cross town or boy on the subways for a music lesson without any worry. So these are very, very interesting issues. In my own field of ethics, I raise it because I think there's a certain impoverishment of the field because we focus so narrowly on what I think are masculine ways of doing ethics. Any other comments? It's always helpful to me to... Yes? Mm-hmm. Nice and loud, please.
Do you feel that holding men can be, holding masculine ways, holding women should be buying into the feminine side?
No. The data is much different from that. Many women, or a significant number of women, think more like men on average, and some men think more like women. And so I don't think you can stereotype any individual at all, which I'm glad for, because even though I love to argue and I'm quite aggressive verbally, I love nurturing behavior. When my kids were very small, I loved diapering and bathing them. My wife has needed intensive care now she's had MS for over 20 years, and for the last 12 years, 14 years, she's needed very intensive care. I love it. I really enjoy that kind of nursing care. Most men don't. Most men don't, on average, enjoy it as much as women. It's just a fact. But I happen to, and I'm very glad that I don't have to feel that somehow I'm less of a man because I enjoy that kind of activity. So, no, we're not talking about individuals. But I think it has implications. I don't know if I mentioned this in an earlier class or not, but did I mention the symposium with Frank Rhodes, our earlier president, before Hunter Rawlings? He gave a talk about a year ago, and he was somewhat bemoaning the fact that a lot of women go into the engineering school and then drop out after a year or so. And he saw that as a severe problem. And afterwards, because I know knew President Rhodes reasonably well, I said, Frank, this is puzzling. I don't see that as a problem at all. I see it as a very good thing because a lot of these gals were pushed into engineering school by overzealous counselors who thought this looks good for them if they can get so many women into engineering and fields like that. And now, after a year or so, they realize they don't like it that much. Some of them love it. And so they say, hey, I don't want to just be a statistic. I'm who I am. I don't like this. I'm getting out. I see that as a very positive thing, just like it doesn't surprise me at all in the vet college that 70 to 80% of the students now are women. I don't think they should try to change that. I think that probably, on average, particularly with animals, and so on, that women probably are more sensitive, intuitive, probably in some ways are able to deal with problems and issues better on average than men. So why should we be upset? But on the other hand, if the field of theoretical math or theoretical physics remains a male-dominated field, I don't see that as a problem. Vive la différence makes life incredibly more interesting. Yes?
It stands that you say that maybe veterinary medicine is, if that's a field that maybe more women are attracted to, that should stand. And then what does that say about the prevalence of men in human medicine?
Well, I think that's changed. Today, I think very close to, we're getting closer to half of the students are women. And I think it's quite possible that over the long term in say, general practice and areas where we're so woefully lacking today, you know, the biggest crisis in a way in American medicine is we have all these specialists, and then we have internists and GPs who are vastly underpaid compared with the specialists, and we're not doing good medicine at that level. I think it's quite possible that women might be able to pull that off much better than men. But I don't think we can approach these issues in a doctrinaire way. We have to simply allow the chips to fall where we will. I think it is, just 1 second, Shannon, and then over here. I think it's almost child abuse, what happened 10, 20 years ago, and to some extent still happens, to try to force little boys to play with Barbie dolls and little girls with erector sets, I think is virtually child abuse. In fact, it usually doesn't succeed. Little boys, they find they do play with Barbie dolls, but they use them as swords. And I think the today, the big problem in K through 12 and increasingly in higher education, there are 40 to 50%, it's about 43% or so more women in college and grad school today than men. And the big problem in K through 12 is we've been so hugely intolerant of male type behavior. As soon as the kid gets a little bit aggressive and rambunctious and so on, we put him on Ritalin, and we cut way back on recess time, and boys aren't supposed to go bang, 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 and you know, or play with swords. This is preposterous in a way, because it has made K through 12 education very, very hurtful in some ways to boys, and it's no problem. It's no wonder that boys today are having hugely more problems in some ways than girls. Shannon?
Oh, no,
Nice and loud.
What do you think about the assertions that fields that tend to be more women dominated, such as veterinarian medicine or pediatrics, are becoming more devalued? They're not seen as important as a decision for university professors as compared to elementary schools?
I don't know what to say about that. I don't know if that's, it's possible, but most veterinarians aren't exactly poor. But it is interesting, for instance, but I think that's more a matter of third-party payment. In medicine, the specialists today are often paid hugely more.
It's not so much like what they're paid, but how society views them.
How you view them. I don't know how to answer that. It's possible that is happening, just as we have so drastically devalued nurturing behavior with children and so on. It's very, very interesting that perhaps the most important social function we do, much more important than anything I do at Cornell, the most important social function we do, we often leave to very low paid, and in some cases not terribly skillful people to do childcare. This to me is just astounding that men and women, husband and wife, who may have a joint income of $200,000, $300,000, pay people $8, $10 an hour or whatever to take care of their little kids, which is in some ways the most important thing we do as a society. This is odd. There was, yes?
You may find that men should get better today than the worse.
Yeah. Sure. May not be totally relevant. I base it on the fact that there is, I think, much less of a sense of honor among men, sexually and so on, than 50 years ago. Just look at some of the movies from the 40s and 50s. You can. Seduce a woman psychologically, and you can jump in and out of bed, and there's very little criticism of this. There's very little attempt to force men to be responsible for getting women pregnant and supporting the child. Men can go around impregnating women and then just abandon them. I mentioned already the data that 85% of all abortions are not wanted by women. They're pushed by men who don't want to take responsibility. All of these things, it seems to me, reflect far worse treatment and far less respect than when I was your age. Now, that sounds incredible to some of you, but I just beg you to think about it. There is a certain... the image of the gentleman who does not take unfair advantage of the woman and so on is by and large a lost image today. And I think that's really sad. Sure, women have more opportunities in many respects, but just the difficulty, a lot of women today are having real difficulty finding good men for husbands because a lot of men don't want to get tied down. They can have all the sex and intimacy they want without the commitments. Why grow up and stop being an adolescent if you can be an adolescent in your 30s and 40s, maybe even 50s? And that is very, very interesting in itself. One of the most disruptive social realities are males between about 16 and 35 or 40 who are unmarried and uncommitted. Marriage is the big, big civilizing factor for males. Males are barbarians. We really are. And marriage is the social institution that ties males to a particular woman and to that woman's children. And it's been a hugely successful social institution over the years. But the downgrading of marriage, there are huge attempts today to almost abolish marriage and to downgrade it, is very destructive. And I think it's much more destructive for women than men, although it's really destructive for both. And one of the theories, for instance, in Saudi Arabia right now, being proposed by some Saudi scholars and some Western scholars, is that you have a whole generation now of young men, grew up with oil money, And in families that had quite a bit of money, they haven't done anything. They haven't gotten a good education. They haven't had to do anything. Many of them unattached. And gradually feeling life is pretty meaningless and purposeless. And along come the Taliban and the Wahhabi and others. And suddenly they're very vulnerable to getting involved in these groups because suddenly life takes on a meaning and there's some discipline and responsibility. So I think there's a lot of evidence that what I'm saying can be substantiated, that in many ways women are treated with far less respect. But, you know, I'm not certain of that. These are judgments that are difficult judgments. Yes? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you just stretching? Or?
No, I'm
losing my hearing, so you need to talk loudly.
Whether we treat women better today than we did 50 years ago. And if I'm wrong about this, I'll shut up quickly, but wasn't it Time magazine that named Ali Abdeel as woman of the year?
Named who?
Ali Abdeel. Am I wrong about this, or did I just make this up?
As woman of the year? And who was she? I don't know who she was.
You know if that's true. That's like something that I heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know the.
Okay.
Yeah.
It partly shocks me that women aren't taken very seriously in the devaluation of professions of women and everything like that, as long as Nationally Read magazine would elect a overly emotional and above all fictitious character as woman of the year.
Well, look at another thing that we allow today. In the name of First Amendment freedoms, which is just bizarre historically, because the First Amendment up until 30, 40 years ago was never, ever used to underwrite pornography and so on, that we allow the sleaziest elements in our society to exploit men and women and children with the television violence and promiscuous sex and so on. This is just astounding. If you look at things like rap music, some of the lyrics and so on, and some of these people get these, are they Emmy Awards or whatever they get, this is preposterous. What kind of respect for women is that? That we allow a whole industry to treat women just as sexual objects and worse. And to have access to our children in this way. This is one of the legitimate complaints, I think, that the Arabs have, the Muslims have, and even the French and others. They don't like all the garbage we're exporting to them. And I think the whole concept of the First Amendment, which was designed to protect political and religious speech, and those are the two areas today that are most in trouble, has now been flipped almost the reverse of it. It's often used mostly to protect pornography and so on. And I think here some of the feminists have understood this. Others have chosen to go the First Amendment route rather than what protects women and highly values femininity and so on. So I think all of this would be evidence that these issues are incredibly more complex and puzzling than we often think. And again, you know, the tragic issue is that if you go into women's studies at Cornell or many of the departments, you don't hear the kind of thing I'm saying. You know, you really just don't hear these kinds of ideas by and large because they've largely been censored out of the curriculum. And that is so tragic because it makes, for one thing, it makes your education so boring. And secondly, it makes it so unuseful in terms of really understanding where we are today. Yes?
Mm-hmm. We've been talking a lot about kind of the ills of American society and things like that. I'm wondering, are you familiar with any societies which have either valued the feminine over the masculine or that have struck much more balance than the women? And if so, how did their societies work?
That's a really tough question. I don't know if I can answer that. I think we've had the feeling sometimes that Sweden and some of these countries have done better. But I'm not sure that's true. I think if you look at measures of happiness and human fulfillment and suicide rates and so on, it's not all that clear to me. Did you want to comment, Rob?
Just the Iroquois Confederacy that had this place before we did, and still has parts of it, is based on a matrilineal decision-making structure.
Mm-hmm.
And also Robert Graves, who you mentioned, I think, in the last lecture, if I'm not mistaken, has written a book called The White Goddess that looks at all the Mediterranean cultures that had matrilineal spirituality and political structure.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a fair amount of stuff out
there about that. Yeah, some of it is hard to evaluate. Some of the stuff that's been written about the Amazons, you know, in antiquity and so on, has been pretty shaky in a scholarly way. So it's very, very hard to know. I don't really know. I'm not sure I want to try to answer that because I'm not sure I know enough about that. But it's a good question. Yes?
You noted earlier when you were talking about children in early education, how the male behavior prejudiced against. I was wondering how that fits with what you were saying about, in general, society prejudice towards male ideals.
I think that's an awfully good question, because I think somehow, let me think about that. I think what I'm describing in K-12 is correct. But on the other hand, somehow when you get out of public school and out of college, you're supposed to go on into the corporate life or into a very successful lawyership or whatever and be really very aggressive and all of this. So there's almost a kind of disconnect there, and it's not surprising to me that so many males drop out. You know, it really is alarming in some ways that they're now in college it's about 57-43 in favor of women, and I think very similar in grad school. That's alarming because a surprising number of really bright young men have just dropped out. And I don't really know, and I'm not sure anyone knows very much why that is. I sent out that email last night on this Dartmouth conference and study that partly tries to explain this. But I think we would be very, very well advised to try to find out, you know, what's happening. Part of the myth is that very masculine men abuse women. That's simply not true. That there's no evidence for that. There is phony masculinity, the kind of machismo Hollywood phony stuff that does. But men who are secure in their masculinity generally do not abuse women or children nearly as much as men who are insecure because they have nothing to prove. They don't need to prove their masculinity by getting trophies and so on. It's just not needed. So that I think it's the same type of thing. Boys who grow up with fathers and fairly good discipline in the home generally will treat women much better than boys who grow up without fathers. So part of the myth has been that it is masculinity as such that has resulted in the abuse of women and so on. I think that's not true. I think that when men are secure in their masculinity, we're better off. And when women are secure in their femininity, we're better off because then they don't have to prove their femininity through promiscuous behavior. They don't have to. One of the problems with girls growing up without fathers is they're much more likely to get pregnant outside of marriage because they're looking for love and looking for identity. We've covered a lot of. It's so interesting to see your faces because some of you look quite skeptical and others are. One last comment. Yeah, we've got a minute yet.
Referring to the First Amendment protection in pornography,
yeah. Yeah.
I think it would be kind of silly to classify something as like Hustler as art. Don't you think though that there is a fine line that while we don't want to sort of praise say music that promotes such treatment of women, that at the same time there has to be a right to make that music?
No, I don't think there's any right at all to make it. I think the Constitution never intended that. And I think when society permits that, and particularly permits these sleazy people to have access to our children, I think we're just plain crazy. And that's why I refer to many of these people as First Amendment fanatics. While at the same time, if you go into our law schools and so on, these people are eroding political speech and religious speech. That's the tragedy. It's not that they're so strong in the First Amendment. It's that they've got psychologically hung up on pornography and don't realize how destructive some of the violence in pornography is to our society. Okay. Thanks. Well, that was a bit controversial, huh?